You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and the National Kidney Foundation estimates that in the U.S., 12 people a day die from kidney failure. There are simply not enough kidney donors to meet the needs of those waiting for a transplant, but perhaps that could all change following the first successful transplant of a kidney from a genetically modified pig. If you have experience with kidney disease and kidney treatments, we welcome your questions and comments and experiences here for the hour at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email available anytime. Ideas at WPR.org. Our guest for the hour, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program. And Dr. Mandelbrot, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Also joining us this morning, Dr. Anna Gaddy is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and treats patients with chronic kidney disease. Dr. Gaddy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Gaddy, I'll start with you. What was your reaction to the news about the very first of its kind of a genetically modified pig being used for a kidney transplant for a 62-year-old man?
I mean, everyone, I think, in the nephrology space was so excited to hear this. It's a tremendous program that did this. So you know that the planning and forethought was solid. And, you know, I'm sure Dr. Mandelbrot will talk more about this, but one of the real issues we run into with our patients who get kidney transplants is, one, there's not enough organs, but two, having to use immunosuppression to prevent rejection is a huge issue. And so the potential that we could use genetic modification to make more organs available through xenotransplantation or to perhaps circumvent some of those needs for immunosuppression is just a really exciting frontier for transplant.
Yeah. And what would this, if you are somebody, a patient with chronic kidney disease, how would you view this medical breakthrough?
So I would imagine that patients would be very hopeful because of this. I have many patients on dialysis who are waiting for a transplant, and of course, there's just a shortage of available organs. And so I think any breakthroughs that can help broaden the pool of organs available for donation is really exciting.
Dr. Mandelbrot, as a medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program, what were the reverberations for you in hearing about the very first of its kind genetically modified pig kidney transplant?
Yeah, it was a huge step forward, and the community is very excited about this. You know, the field of xenotransplantation, or, you know, the idea of transplanting organs from animals into humans, is old. The concept is old, really 40, 50 years ago. And longer, people have been talking about this and thinking and starting experiments. For many years at meetings, people would make the comment that xenotransplant is the future of transplantation, and it always will be the future of transplantation. There's this thought that it just was endless. We would keep looking for solutions. And now I think there's just a huge leap forward in optimism. This is a successful xenotransplant, and it's obviously a first step. It's just one transplant, everybody understands that further research is necessary to really refine the process to better define benefits as well as risks. There's just a great increase in optimism, and I think it'll have a huge impact in the coming years.
Dr. Mandelbrot, a researcher from UW Health and the UW Center for Biomedical Swine Research and Innovation, were part of this team that genetically engineered the donor pig for Massachusetts General Hospital's patient. Why are pig organs a viable option for transplantation here? What is it about them?
Yeah, there are several factors that contribute. One is simply that the size of the pig's kidney is very well matched. It's very similar to the size of human kidneys. And it also turns out that pigs have a very short life cycle. So they're very amenable to breeding and to genetic modifications that can be done fairly quickly. Rather than having to make sort of one genetic modification and waiting years for that pig to breed, it's something that can be done rapidly. And then I think that the third big factor is that pigs are already, you know, there's pig farms already. You know, the world and the United States already consumes many pigs. So the idea of making pig farms of genetically modified pigs for the purpose of saving lives and doing transplants is sort of much more readily acceptable by society.
So according to the journal Nature, they say 69 pig genes were removed from this pig donor before the transplant into the 62-year-old man a couple of weeks ago. Why is that, Dr. Mandelbrot? What were they editing out there?
Yeah, so actually, many of the edits were editing out. Some were actually editing in. And there's actually three different categories of gene modifications. Some of the modifications were to get rid of sugar molecules on the pig organs that cause very rapid rejection. There were, for many years of research, really a barrier to doing transplants from animals. So several of those molecules on the surface of the organs were removed. But then a number of molecules were actually added in. And those molecules are molecules that basically, they're actually human molecules that suppress the immune system, suppress the recipient's immune response to those organs. And interestingly, the majority of the changes, 59 out of the 69 changes, were actually to remove potential viruses in the pig genome, because that's been one of the main concerns over the years. From xenotransplantation, that potentially a virus that is found in pigs and is not harmful to pigs could potentially be transplanted along with those organs and then potentially become dangerous to humans. So 59 pig viruses that had incorporated into the genome were removed by this new technology, the CRISPR technology, that's allowed such major breakthroughs in terms of gene modifications.
That's Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, who is a medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program, also joining us this hour. Dr. Anna Gaddy, who is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and we invite you with your questions, comments, and experiences with kidney disease at 800 and treatment at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. And Dr. Gaddy, how do we begin to weigh some of the ethical balances that may come into play when it comes to xenotransplantation here?
So the first thing that comes to my mind when I'm thinking about ethical issues with this transplant is that, you know, obviously we don't have data for how this organ's going to perform longitudinally. You know, we know that while pigs have a quicker life cycle, they also don't live as long as humans. And so I think there's a lot to be said for having 10 years of data to tell a patient, to assure them that, you know, the benefits of getting a transplant from a pig, not just in terms of it won't reject, but it will last as long as a human kidney would last. I think we're quite a ways from being able to give them that certainty. So that's the biggest one that comes to my mind. The other things that I think could be issues are that, you know, right now getting a transplant from a human that's well matched is the gold standard. And so being very careful about how we use xenotransplant to extend our pool versus to replace our pool, and who we would be offering human organs to versus who we would be offering xenotransplant organs to. I think there's a lot of gray area there that we'll need to work through ethically.
Dr. Mandelbrot, what would need to happen before the Food and Drug Administration would approve pig kidney transplants, the likes of which we saw for the very first time here just a few weeks ago?
Yeah, if I could, just before I answer that, just go back to the ethical question, because I think it's an important one. And I think I agree with all the points Dr. Gaddy made, but one additional point to emphasize, because I looked this up a few days ago, every year, the United States consumes over 100 million pigs, so for food. And the idea here is that the entire, you know, waiting list for organs is on the order of 100,000. So, you know, it would be just essentially a drop in the bucket of additional pigs that would be used for purposes of saving lives. I think in the early days, and there still may be some concerns about the ethics of using animals, but that was one of the reasons why pigs were such a successful model, that there are already so many more pigs being, you know, consumed for bacon or ham than would be needed for saving lives. So I think that that's now felt to be a relatively minor concern.
Doctor, I appreciate that. And well, let me let's take a second here. And when we continue, we will get an answer to where the FDA goes from here when it comes to xenotransplantation. And the first of its kind, we just saw a couple weeks ago at Massachusetts General Hospital, where a 62-year-old man received a genetically modified kidney from a pig for the very first time. Our guest for the hour, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program. And Dr. Anna Getty is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and volunteers with the National Kidney Foundation of Wisconsin. You're welcome here, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking to two kidney specialists in Wisconsin about the latest advancements in treating kidney disease and the first of its kind successful transplant of a genetically modified pig kidney into a human patient just a few weeks ago. Our guest, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and Dr. Anna Getty, nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, treating patients with chronic kidney disease. We welcome you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Dr. Mandelbrot, where we left off was the path that this xenotransplantation may take to getting FDA approval. What will that path look like, and what could the timeline be?
Yeah, so this particular transplant was done under what's generally called by the FDA the compassionate use. And the idea is that that's for a one time or a small number of experiments, if you will. And there's a number of steps that still need to go, that the field needs to go through before reaching FDA approval. There'd be a small number of individuals and then presumably a series of patients receiving xenotransplants, potentially even randomized controlled trials. So this is probably a timeline of years, which again, in the history of xenotransplantation, as many decades, is relatively short, but still it's required before any sort of treatment can be widely adopted.
Taking a step back here, Dr. Getty, when does a kidney go bad? What's considered an unhealthy kidney, and when is it important to get treatment here?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. So the burden of chronic kidney disease in the United States is just enormous. And the vast majority of people with chronic kidney disease don't know that they have it. So when I describe to patients that chronic kidney disease is a scarring type of process, it's until it reaches the very, very, very late stages, has no symptoms. And so it's really important that patients get routine primary care so that they can avoid not only the diseases that lead to chronic kidney disease, like hypertension and diabetes, but also that they can be screened for chronic kidney disease with a regular, on a regular schedule. And so chronic kidney disease happens for a variety of reasons, but by far the biggest contributors in the United States are diabetes and hypertension. And so there's really no symptoms until the kidney, it's a remarkable organ and can there's a lot of redundancy. And so it can really make up for some of its own shortcomings and hyperfiltrate, we say, for a long time. So you really wouldn't have any symptoms until you were almost to the point of no return. So primary care and screening is absolutely essential.
Dr. Mandelbrot, in January, just this past January, UW Health celebrated its second longest living kidney recipient. A 74-year-old Wisconsin woman has a functioning kidney that's actually older than she is at 98 years old. How long can a kidney function after a transplant, doctor?
Yeah, there's really no theoretical limit. That's a good example. We have a number of kidney transplant recipients whose kidneys have lasted, I think the record is 57 years, but we have a number that have lasted 40, 50 years. There's a number of factors that influence how long those kidneys can last. His episodes of rejection certainly contribute to kidneys lasting less long. Probably one of the biggest factors is actually other illnesses or comorbidities that the kidney transplant recipient has. So if they have hypertension and diabetes, those conditions can actually recur in the kidney transplant. But I think that, again, there's no theoretical limit. And patients that I see in clinic who have excellent kidney function after 20 years, I usually tell them that I expect the kidney to last at least another 20 years. There's again, no theoretical limit.
We're talking about kidney disease and transplants. Our guests are Dr. Didier Mandelbrot at UW Health and Dr. Hannah Gatti from the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we welcome you to the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Dr. Gatti, when do you typically recommend patients for a kidney transplant?
That's a great question. So we recommend patients who have been seeing a nephrologist longitudinally be referred for kidney transplant when their GFR, or roughly that percentage of kidney function, gets down to about 20%. There's always a sweet spot. What we're trying to do is ideally get them a transplant before they ever need dialysis to replace the function of their kidney. So we're always aiming to get patients listed and find them, do all the workup to be listed and make sure that they're a good, healthy transplant candidate, and then get them a transplant before their kidney actually gets to the point that it is not able to do its job anymore. So there's really a timing aspect of it that's best served if you've been seeing a nephrologist for a while.
And how does that timing come up against the transplant organ donor list?
That's a great question. So there's really, with all transplants, all organ transplants, there's you need to be sick enough that there's a greater benefit than risk to getting a transplant. And so if you've got some time left on your kidneys, it's always best to use the kidney that you have, or whatever organ you're talking about. It's always best to use the organ function that you have. And so you can imagine that, as Dr. Mandelbrot mentioned, there's a huge wait list in the United States for a kidney. And so if patients are not able to find a relative or a friend to donate a kidney to them, then they're put on a list where they wait for a donor who has deceased. And so, of course, that's a very difficult thing to estimate timing for. And certain patients conditions that make them, you know, a more difficult blood type, or maybe a difficult body size to match, that makes them a harder candidate to get matched. So that's some of where specialty nephrology care comes into play, is that your nephrologist can estimate your risk of how hard you would be as a candidate and refer you slightly earlier. For example, I have some patients who I know anatomically, because they've had surgeries in their abdomen, are going to be a little bit more challenging to find a good transplant for. And so I refer those patients slightly earlier than I would, for example, a completely anatomically normal patient. Just an example.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And Dr. Mandelbrot, Dr. Gatti talks about how sick a patient has to be before they'd recommend a kidney transplant. But how do you determine whether a patient is healthy enough to receive a kidney transplant?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the central problem that you alluded to in your introduction is really the shortage of kidneys to transplant. And another way of thinking about that, or the result of that, is that waiting times for kidney transplants are really very long, depending on your blood type and historically the region of the country. The waiting lists are on the order of 3 to 6 years. And so some patients, in particular, actually, this one patient who was transplanted recently in Mass General was doing so badly with dialysis that he was really motivated to go ahead and participate in this experiment, because he had been both on dialysis and had a transplant and then was back on dialysis. And here he really felt that he essentially couldn't take it anymore for another 5 years. The promise of xenotransplantation is to basically eliminate the waiting list. Unfortunately, the waiting list, again, is such a central problem. Every year, you know, thousands of patients die waiting for an organ because of the organ shortage. So having an essentially unlimited supply of organs would mean that all these patients, instead of declining as they're waiting for an organ, would be able to be transplanted promptly. So, but to go back to your question, there still is, there probably are a number of patients who would not be able to tolerate the transplant just for technical reasons.
Dr. Mandelbrot, I'm sorry, we got a news coming up here, and we will get back to our conversation this hour, taking a look at the treatments of kidney disease, the diagnosis and the prevention of kidney disease as well, and organ transplantation. We invite you to the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Now that we have our first successful transplant of a genetically modified pig kidney into a patient dying from kidney failure, what does the future hold for treating kidney disease and for organ transplants? Our guest this hour, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, Medical Director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and Dr. Anna Gatti, nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She also volunteers with the National Kidney Foundation of Wisconsin. And we invite you to our conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Gary and Rippon, we go to you next. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. On January 8 of this year, I had one of my kidneys removed, not for purposes of transplantation. So my question is there some particular things I should be doing to try to keep the other one that I still have?
I bet there are, Gary, and let's ask Dr. Gatti just that. Dr. Gatti, Gary's down to one kidney after a surgery to start this year. How should he go forward and protect it?
Great question, Gary. I'm glad your mind is on this, and I'm glad you're doing well after your surgery. So the biggest things, you know, you have two kidneys, and as we always say, you can live just fine with one. But the things that you need to be careful for are to make sure that that kidney stays as healthy as possible. And so, as always, that the biggest thing is making sure you're seeing your doctor regularly to make sure that your blood pressure and your blood sugar are well controlled and that you're not developing any other health issues, sort of screening to make sure that that kidney is staying healthy with urine and blood tests every year. The things you can do are to make sure that you're not putting yourself in situations where you're becoming volume depleted or what we think of as dehydrated. So if you're out working in the hot sun this summer, or if you're out on a boat or golfing, make sure that you are eating enough, that you're staying in the shade, that you're drinking enough water. If you start to feel faint, make sure you get inside of the shade and get rehydrated quickly. And if you're getting sick, if you get, for example, a GI bug and you start to vomit or have diarrhea and you're feeling, you know, dizzy or like you're not able to keep food down, have a very low threshold. You don't muscle through those types of situations the way you maybe did previously. Go straight to the emergency room and get some IV fluids for those situations. You just have to baby your kidney a bit more. And the things that your kidney really hates are times when your blood pressure is dangerously low. So be on the lookout for those. And then long-term, taking care of yourself, making sure that you're eating healthy foods so that you don't develop diabetes or high blood pressure, avoiding salt as much as possible, and trying to minimize how much non-steroidal medications you use, which would be Advil, ibuprofen, Motrin, or Aleve, which is naproxen.
Thank you for that. And Gary, thank you for the call at 1-800-642-1234. Dr. Mandelbrot, before the news, we were talking about how you thread that needle where a patient who is sick enough to need a transplant but healthy enough to receive one in a way that would be successful. I want to return to that because you oversee the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and you'd reach 12,000 kidney donations back in 2022. So with that in mind, what is your program doing to improve transplant outcomes, and how does, you know, deciding who should be a recipient of a transplant play into that?
Yeah, so our report of our long history of kidney transplants, one of the main findings, which we confirmed what others have found, is that outcomes from transplantation have really improved over the decades. Outcomes from dialysis, as it turns out, have also improved over the decades. But in general, for most patients with kidney failure, transplantation is a better option. There's still some, and the promise of xenotransplantation is to make dialysis much less common. The idea is if we could supply organs to that 100,000 or so patients waiting for a kidney, those 100,000 or so patients would not need to be on dialysis. But there are still some patients who really are too sick to be able to benefit from kidney transplantation. And that's one of the things that's we spend a lot of time evaluating patients and trying to improve their health, whether it's to improve the status of any heart disease they might have, or vascular disease, or lung disease, to get them to the point where they would be healthy enough to be able to get through the surgery itself. Yeah, so xenotransplantation would not solve those risks that are associated with the transplant procedure itself. Again, we spend a lot of time and effort trying to improve the status of patients so that they can get those long-term benefits of transplant and make those long-term benefits worth the short-term risks, because there always is some short-term risk associated with the surgical procedure itself.
Sure, and let's. I want to take a moment to look at dialysis. And Dr. Gaddy, I'll start with you here. You prescribe dialysis to some of your chronic kidney disease patients. How frequently do they need dialysis?
So most people who need dialysis need it 3 times per week. That's the standard in this country. In some countries, we do up to 5 times a week. And it basically, when you're doing dialysis, you're trying to do the kidney's job. What the kidney does 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, normally we're trying to squeeze into a short enough period of time that people can still live a life. And so for most patients, that's 3 times per week at 4 hours per session. So it's 12 hours plus, getting there, getting back. And a lot of patients don't feel great after dialysis, so that's kind of the day for them. So it winds up really being 3 full days per week of, we often describe it as having a part-time job.
It sounds like it could be close to a full-time job. Dr. Mandelbrot, there are some patients who survive through dialysis for more than 30 years. Is long-term dialysis improving?
Yeah, definitely. Over the years, I have met patients who had been on dialysis even 30 or 40 years.
Wow.
Had been, worked full-time as doctors and lawyers and raised families. But those are generally the exception. We roughly say that dialysis, half of patients on dialysis die after 5 years. So there's, despite, significant improvements over time of dialysis treatments, it's still a difficult life, and most people struggle with dialysis. So again, that's why so often transplantation is a much better solution.
Dr. Gaddy, once you are on dialysis, is there a way to wean yourself off of it?
That's an interesting question. I saw the article about progressive weaning of patients from dialysis, and I just want to clarify that weaning patients off dialysis is useful for a particular type of kidney injury that we call an acute kidney injury. And that happens when someone has something short-term happen, when they were previously very healthy, and then they get in, for example, a car accident, and their kidney is stunned, and they need dialysis to do the kidney's job while the kidney is waking up. That is not the case in patients who have chronic kidney disease, whose kidneys have been, as I said, scarring over the process of decades. For the vast majority of patients, once they get on dialysis from chronic kidney disease, they need dialysis forever until they can get a kidney transplant. there are some patients with acute kidney injury who we can basically, their kidneys start to wake up and then we can slow down or wean or just stop altogether the dialysis therapy after time.
Dr. Anna Gaddy from the Medical College of Wisconsin, also joining us, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot from UW Health. And you are invited as well at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. And before we go back to your calls, Dr. Mandelbrot, what about at-home dialysis? Is this something that is up and coming? Is this a new technology that could be useful for folks who rely on dialysis three times a week?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's not exactly new. The concept's been around, I think, on the order of 30 years. But its adoption has continued to increase. And it does seem to provide better outcomes and better quality of life than so-called in-center hemodialysis. You know, there's, I guess, two types of home dialysis. One is peritoneal dialysis, and the other is home hemodialysis. And they are associated with better quality of life, more freedom, less, you know, requirement to get to a transplant center at a specific time and dialyze at a specific time. So in general, the outcomes of home hemodialysis seem to be better than the outcomes of in-center hemodialysis. And the nephrology community, as well as the government, have been encouraging the increased use of home hemodialysis now for a number of years. So I think the technology is there. I think a lot of the barriers now have to do with reimbursement and logistics. But still, in general, a transplant will provide better outcomes than even home hemodialysis.
Back to the phones now, where Ray in Milwaukee is standing by. Ray, good morning.
Good morning. I want to speak about something that you really don't hear about at all for some reason. Excess deaths in the United States 2022-2023 was over 110,000 excess deaths. That's deaths above the normal rate. The insurance companies are freaking out about this, but for some reason, our government never talks about it, but I wonder how that impacts availability for organ donors, because most of these excess deaths in these 2 years that I'm speaking of have been young, healthy people who would be excellent candidates to donate an organ.
Interesting, Ray. I hadn't even thought of that. And Dr. Mandelbrot, I'll turn to you as the medical director of the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Programs. Are unexpected deaths in the U.S., does that play a role in our transplant system?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it does. You know, there are a number of causes for those excess deaths. You know, during the COVID pandemic, clearly that was one major factor. The narcotic deaths, overdoses, unfortunately, there's still an epidemic. Climate change has increased heat-related deaths. As the caller points out, some of those deaths are in young, healthy people. And so that probably has contributed in part to the increased number of deceased donor transplants that have been performed in recent years. So from the transplant side of the coin, you know, we look at curves and the number of deceased donor transplants have increased, you know, a little bit every year, some ups and downs, but overall the trend has been to increase. But the unfortunate other side, of course, is that that's due to increased deaths among the population as well. Some of it is, of course, better utilization of organs. We'd like to think that we continue to improve on that side. That's true that the excess deaths have contributed to that.
Dr. Mandelbrot from the UW Health Kidney Pancreas Transplantation Program, also joining us for this hour, Dr. Anna Gaddy, nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and there's still time for you as well at 1-800-642-1234. Questions and comments about kidney disease, treatments, and transplantation? Join us before our hour is up at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we just don't know how many people are living with kidney disease. And Dr. Gaddy mentioned it. It's because, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as many as 9 in 10 adults in the U.S. who have kidney disease don't know it. Well, then how do you treat it? We're talking about our kidneys this morning with our guest, Dr. Didier Mandelbrot, who oversees the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program, and Dr. Anna Gaddy, who is a nephrologist with the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we invite you to our conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to James in Door County next. James, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'm a retired general surgeon, and when I was in training in the 80s, transplantation, particularly kidney transplantation, wasn't really being done in the older population. So I'm wondering, what is the success rate now with renal transplantation in patients who are, say, over 65 years old?
Doctor?
Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, appreciate the question, doctor. Thank you. Dr. Mandelbrot, what's the success rate been for the older populations in these kidney transplants?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the outcomes have been generally good. The trends, which have been shown by many others, as well as our recent report of our 12,000 transplants at UW, show that the average age of patients undergoing transplant has continued to increase. And in general, as you know, for any surgical procedure, we know that there's a difference between sort of chronological age, or the age on paper, and the physiological age, or you know, how much wear and tear there is on the body, if you will. And we know that somebody who's 75 but is able to exercise regularly and has limited, heart disease, lung disease, et cetera, can do very well with the transplant, and can not only improve their quality of life, but often increase their length of life. And to bring it back to the xenotransplant question, there are patients that we've seen over the years who, you know, may be borderline candidates now, but if they're, say, you know, 80 years old and their expected wait time is 6 years, you know, the odds are that that patient would not be a good candidate by the time they receive the deceased donor organ. So the promise of xenotransplantation would be that we could look at a patient who's, say, 80 years old and say, well, you don't have to wait. You're an okay candidate now. We don't have to make any sort of assumptions or guesses about whether or not you might be a candidate in 5 years. And we could go ahead and do a transplant. So again, one of the many reasons why I think xenotransplantation would open doors for a lot of patients to be able to undergo transplantation.
Dr. Gaddy, got a question here from Sarah in La Crosse, who wants to know how we eat and drink affects our kidneys, and what can we eat and drink that would benefit our kidneys the most?
That's a great question. That's one I get a lot in clinic. One of the things that I hear a lot, and I know this is really, really prominent in pop culture, is that drinking a lot of water is great for your kidneys. And that's a myth. Your body is really quite good at telling you when you need water. So the idea that drinking, you know, 5 liters of water a day is going to flush out your kidneys is not true. And so I would really encourage people to try to eat generally a healthful diet in portions that can sustain a healthy body weight and a healthy blood sugar, and avoiding salt above 2 grams per day. So I usually recommend that patients try to eat less than 2,000 milligrams of sodium per day. And that is the best thing you can really do to keep your kidneys healthy. Other than that, focus on eating plant-based foods, eating a nice round diet with some vegetables, some lean protein, some fruits, some grains. But there's really not a diet that can prevent kidney disease. It's just whatever helps you maintain good blood sugars and good blood pressure. So for most people, avoiding excess salt in the diet above 2 grams of sodium per day is usually that top limit of what we want people consuming. And then drink to thirst.
Dusty and Madison, we go to you next. Good morning.
Hi, friends. My name is Dusty. I'm a 2-time kidney transplant recipient through UW-Madison. I was on hemodialysis, did some peritoneal at home And actually, I'm in my 30s. I actually have a transplant from my dad, who's in his 60s. And so I just want to thank you all for the great work there. I did have a question about more of, so we talked about the xenotransplantation. What about more of the mechanical kidney stuff? I've seen some stuff out of UC Davis about mechanical kidneys and then the internal membrane systems there. Is that something you guys are pursuing?
Dusty, glad to hear you're doing well. Dr. Mandelbrot, mechanical hardware for our kidneys.
Yeah, there's definitely interest in that approach as well. There's I'm not familiar with any research specifically on that at UW, although that doesn't 100% mean that there's not none going on. UCSF and there are a number of other places across the country have been working on that. And it has various terms. Some people think of it as sort of portable dialysis or, an artificial mechanical kidney. It's still got a ways to go because the kidney does so many different things. In other words, it's not just the mechanics of a kidney, which is quite complex in terms of filtering water and electrolytes and, retaining water and electrolytes when appropriate. But the kidney has a number of hormonal functions having to do with regulating calcium and phosphate, regulating red blood cell production, et cetera. So I think that's an important area of research. Clearly, transplantation is already here and working. Although I don't have a crystal ball, I suspect that especially with some of these recent developments in xenotransplantation and the fact that those transplanted kidneys really seem to do everything that the kidney needs to do, I think that's probably more likely to have an impact in the coming years and decade than a mechanical kidney.
Thank you for the question, Dusty, and we are already down to our last minute. Dr. Gaddy, why should folks consider becoming a kidney donor today?
Oh, great question. Because as we've talked about, xenotransplantation is likely many, many years away for the general public and going prime time. But, you really only need one of your two kidneys. If you are healthy, you can live a wonderful life with one kidney. It's obviously a big ask, but considering donating a kidney to a loved one or even to a stranger you don't know is a wonderful way to make a positive impact on the world. And Wisconsin has some great tax benefits for kidney donors and some great protections. But generally, it's just a really good deed.
Dr. Gaddy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Dr. Mandelbrot, thank you as well to you. Really appreciate your time and information.
Thank you.
Didier Mandelbrot is the medical director of the UW Health Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation Program. Dr. Anna Gaddy is a nephrologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and treats patients with chronic kidney disease. The Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.